Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Inside Writing. This show is presented by Gotham Writers Workshop, offering writing classes of all types and sizes. You can visit us at gothamwriters.com. Moving into the show for today, which is about travel writing, a quick reminder that at any point in the episode, you can submit your own questions for our panelists using the Q&A button down there on your Zoom dashboard. If you click it, it will open up a little window. You can submit your questions. The sooner you do that, the better. So please do submit those questions as soon as you have them. We will jump into the show now. We're going to begin the way we always do with a quote, this one from Mark Twain, of all people, who said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of humans and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." We're going to talk more about that later. But now let's meet our panelists. Our first panelist, author of the memoir Brother One Cell, as well as pieces in the New York Times, USA Today, GQ, The Rumpus, and more, Cullen Thomas. Hello, Cullen.
Hello, everybody. Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And our second panelist, editor-in-chief of Panorama Magazine, as well as a writer with pieces appearing in National Geographic and BBC Travel, Amy Gigi Alexander. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you both for being here. So we're going to start the questioning where we always do. Amy, I want to ask you first, if you had to define travel writing in the simplest terms, how would you define it? What does it mean to you?
Travel writing is any writing that includes a journey.
I like that. I like the simplicity. And Colin, how about you?
I mean, it could be poetry, fiction, nonfiction, but it has to have a journey in it. Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah, it's hugely broad, Josh. I would just say one word, adventure.
I like that. So adventure and journey. So let's segue into what sort of a follow-up to that question, which is, you know, what the purpose of travel writing is. And you both mentioned you're more on the literary side of travel writing. So Cullen, starting with you, what is your goal when you write a travel piece? What is it that you're trying to accomplish with it?
You know, I'll borrow the words of David Miller, who's the guy who started Matador, and kick-ass stories, you know, to tell a great story, really. Again, as Amy said, whether it's fictional or nonfiction, just to educate and entertain in equal measure.
Mm-hmm. Amy, anything to add to that?
Well, I started Panorama because I saw kind of a lack in what could be published in travel writing. And I think that travel writing's main power is that it is the only genre that requires someone to go somewhere, either in their imagination or in reality, to transform the reader. So our own transformation when we go somewhere is the thing that is the bridge for the person reading it. The person reading it may never experience a thing we've experienced, but we can call up something in them, and travel writing has that incredible power to transform the reader, pretty much unlike anything else, because the person may never have the experience we have. It's transformative, primarily.
So I want to get back to something you said there in a bit, but at first I got to ask, just as far as the logistics of travel writing goes, with your process as a writer, Amy, do you travel knowing that you're going to write about it, or do you just kind of travel for fun and then run into things that you want to write about?
Well, I can travel. I live in Mexico, and I can travel just leaving my apartment and going down to the tienda on the corner, because a journey doesn't require going far. It just requires going somewhere where I don't know really what's going on. Sometimes I have started out pieces having an interest in something, particularly commercial pieces, where I had an interest in something, and then something else bloomed and something else bloomed, and a piece came out of it, but I started out with research. And other times, as far as literature, it's more of a series of accidents that happen. Just accidental things. I just put myself in risky situations or situations that are uncomfortable. And because they're uncomfortable, I have a story to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Like that, Amy, that sense of testing yourself and how that it's a thing I guess we should recommend with hesitation, especially in our very careful and yes, our very careful modern world. But yeah, that taking of a risk, that getting outside of one's comfort zone. I was thinking of that great quotation, forgive the academic moment, but that I just love the rousing idea of a ship at harbor is safe, but that's not what ships are for.
Right. Yes, that's so true. That's so true. I think, like, going off of that, the idea of risk traditionally in travel writing is really connected to colonial tropes, like things like person X goes somewhere and explores something and discovers something. But what we're seeing in travel writing now is that people in the places that were, quote, discovered are now writing their own place. The idea that you could travel your own city, for example, you don't, risk can be just thinking about something in a different way. It doesn't have to be necessarily going and swimming with sharks or doing something death-defying. It could be going and doing something alone, or it could be going and doing something that you don't like and finding that you like it. So it could be something small. It doesn't have to necessarily be epic. And I say that as someone who's done a lot of epic things, of course, but I publish a lot of things that are not epic and they're small. Just someone walking around their city or taking a bus across town can be a travel piece.
Yeah, I thought also, Amy, it sounded like you were turning towards the, where travel writing does get maligned, perhaps, especially if we look at it through a modern lens of social justice, which it often is seen through, which, you know, confronts that picture of the white Victorian explorer writing these, you know, wonderful tales of the indigenous, and aren't we so bold and courageous? But there's so much other great kinds of travel writing, and especially the modern use of it for purposes of social justice, a kind of higher ideal. In fact, it was contained in that Twain quote you read, Josh, a humanist element to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. There's nothing I don't disagree with. I agree with all that.
So you all brought up some big points that I want to get back to, but I want to get back to the logistics, the writing process of whenever you're writing a particular piece. So, Colin, I want to start with you. Whenever you take a travel, whether it's a walk or a vacation, how soon will you start writing? Is it something you're writing as you're doing it, or do you take some time to mull it over and then come back to it later?
Yeah, I'm sure for Amy and many of the people who are joining us here, they perhaps experience both. And I always encourage writers to do both. You are a writer with tools and knowledge. You're not just one story, and you're not just one technique. So I definitely carry notebooks around with me. Notebook and pen always shows up on the lists of what a writer needs, even in the modern era, with smartphones and incredible technology, but you can't beat the notebook and pen. Some stories I've done, yes, it's fantastic to realize in the midst of a trip or an adventure or an exploration that you're in the midst of something very cool. You're in the midst of something interesting, and you take notes and you record and you capture scenes and you capture dialogue, in particular, contemporaneously captured, in also sensory detail, the specifics of settings, the specific things people say, and getting that contemporaneously as the experience is happening, or when you can step away after the bus ride, you know, when you come back from the dinner, or when you have a moment alone in your treetop hut, whatever it is, and then you can get those notes down, you know, journaling, of course, writing down the most salient and interesting things that happen during a day at the end of that day. All of that has been super valuable to me in certain stories I've done, but then other times And again, I think all of us will recognize this. Experiences take years to gestate, and we come back to them, God willing, inshallah, we can come back to them decades later and look back on those trips and find great stories.
Mm-hmm. Amy, what about you? What's your process like? Is it
very
like
different? Very different than this process. I'm very note oriented. My mentor was Tim Cahill when I first started out, and he always told me take copious notes, and I always have taken copious notes, and I never don't take notes. I never take a break from not taking notes. I think that's why my pieces have as much detail as they have in them. But also, something I do use is a tape recorder. And that's not necessarily to tape people, but I might tape myself walking through a market. I might tape myself walking in the forest or being in a forest or something like that, because I take all that for granted when I'm in that place and I'm in that landscape, and I don't detect all the subtle nuances that I will need to make my piece into this magical thing that I want it to be, that flows so beautifully, that makes you feel like you're there. So tape recording really helps me. And you haven't asked this yet, but also after the fact, listening to the noises similar to like where I was, there's a wonderful website that is just Sounds of Paris. This guy that has, it's all sound bites of Paris, and he walks all over Paris. And if I was writing about Paris, I would look at his website, go to the place that he went, listen to it, because it will key my memory. Even if I take good notes, I might not. I will say that since Instagram and all of that, I think people have a tendency to take photographs to say, this photo will capture this, so I won't take notes. But a photograph is not the same as writing it down. And so that can become a weakness, I think. But generally, notes, yeah. A lot of notes, a lot of notebooks. Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. The more you capture in the moment, the easier it's going to be to recreate those necessary scenes down the line. That is absolutely true. Tim Cahill, I like that attribution there. I very much like his writing.
Yeah, I mean, he always would say, you are your notes. Your piece is only as good as your notes, you know?
I like that.
And I think that's true. And oftentimes I'm teaching a course to somebody and they want to write something that happened 30 years ago and they have no notes on it. They have nothing. So is it true?
Yeah, you start to lose.
Or is it Bruce Chatwin's in Patagonia all over again? I mean, how true is it? And so there becomes what we want a story to be, and then there's what actually happened. And so notes are our greatest tool, you know, writing as we go.
Yeah, and amen to what you just said, Amy, in terms of keeping that distinction between fantasy and fiction and nonfiction. And of course, there's great travel writing across the spectrum, but it's important that we keep that gap. There is a big world of difference.
Mm-hmm. And Amy, I'm curious, because if somebody has had that experience that they maybe didn't even think at the time was worth writing about, but then 10 years down the road, they think, oh, this is something I want to revisit, but they don't have the notes. Do you have ways, or do you have advice for people?
Yeah. I've just been teaching a whole bunch of courses right now where people have had that issue. Mm-hmm. So one of the things to do, I suggest, is going back and finding images from that time, looking for sentimental objects or things you brought back from that trip, and writing lists off of the objects. So if you brought something back, start writing lists so you can start calling up memory. Like you have a basket and you remember that the person who sold you the basket was wearing green, and then suddenly you remember the market, and then you remember what happened that day, and then you remember you were sick, and it's all sort of linked together. The practice of writing lists in general about objects can also, not even about your trip, but just in general, can help your brain start thinking differently so that you're more relational, more relationship oriented in your work. I also suggest sometimes that, for example, if someone's writing about a train journey, that they go to, say, YouTube or another app, and they find videos of train journeys and turn off the sound and just watch it. Like watch the same train journey, or watch or listen to a train to see what comes up for them. There's a lot. Make the food that you ate, you know, go read about the country again, see what spurs. If you were traveling with someone, talk to them, you know, see if you sent them an email or a letter. It honestly, one little thing can can spur an entire tome, an entire novel, or an entire memoir. It just takes one small switch.
Just a little petite Madeline.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It just can take one small thing. But I find the main way, the way to open that door is through sensory detail, extensive sensory detail. And so focusing on auditory things, visual things, and kinesthetic things really help. Kinesthetic being how you move through a place, and trying to mimic that experience for yourself will generally bring back a lot of the story.
That's I think that's great advice, Amy. You are causing me to think of Don George and his advice, the Lonely Planet and National Geographic writer. I like to use his advice and good guidance for writers in my classes, but he says very much what you're saying. I think it's fantastic advice. The auditory
He was the person that gave me my start.
Don George.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was the first person to publish my work, so small world.
That's what, that's
nice man. Very nice man. Yeah.
Yeah. Well traveled man, and good advice. He's always pushing those sensory details. I like the way, you know, bringing even mnemonics and psychology into it. What I love, Amy, too, about your advice is that layer of the writer trying to recreate the experience can very often be a powerful part of the story itself.
Yeah, I agree with you. That, I mean, I think in trying to create, like, someone will oftentimes have a story that they wanted to write for a very long time, and they've been holding on to that story. And for whatever reason, either whatever happened is too important, or they don't think that they have the skill set to be able to do it, or they don't have the notes. But in general, in trying to write it, it's transformative all over again. You know, it's a transformative experience going through all of it again to be able to articulate it into something that they want, something that they want to be beautiful. But again, I think it's through sensory detail that you can really, and the other thing I would suggest is to try to write the story entirely in present tense, as though it's happening, at least on the rough draft, before you turn it into anything else, to try to keep it in the present tense. Because oftentimes, if you're writing about something that happened a long time ago, you miss the intimacy, the connection, and the reader can feel space and sort of a disconnect. And so by starting it entirely in the present tense, as though it's happening, it forces you to do the work.
Interesting. And then the writer can always decide, perhaps, to suffuse it with more retrospection and switch to the aspects.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, that also keeps them in more of the, which I'm sure we're going to talk about more in the showing and telling state of mind. It keeps it live, keeps it more live for them in the rough draft stage, and then at least the first time they try to write it, and then to change it afterwards if they want to.
That actually segues right into what I was going to ask about showing and telling. Cullen, we'll start with you. We always have to tell our students to decide between what you want to show and what you want to tell. With travel writing, do you have that? Like, it feels like you have to show pretty much everything. How do you go about deciding what you're going to show and what you're going to tell?
I think travel writing is a beautiful blend of both of those, right? Because I think what brings a lot of people to travel writing, a lot of the students and writers I've worked with as an editor or collaborator. In fact, it is part of what brings them to it. Part of what attracts them to it is the history, is the ballast, the journalism, is the authority that the writer could bring to it, ideally, right? You want to write with some authority, a journalist who is sent to Slovenia to write about it, who doesn't know anything about it, would educate herself or himself about it. You do that research. I think a lot of writers who are drawn to travel writing have a good inkling for the telling. And right, what is the telling? Well, reflection and thinking on the page and history and facts and statistics and quotations and your narration about all of the things story always comes back to. Motive and desire and goal and why are you there and what are you seeking and how is it changing you, right? How is it changing you? I think it was a Tim Cahill story where he's hiking in British Columbia. I think it was for Outside Magazine. And he falls and he injures himself. And yes, there are lessons learned and morals drawn and meaning taken out of the scenes. It's one thing to write a great scene. In some ways, that's the easier part of the craft to learn, to write a good scene. But the other stuff, the thinking, the meaning, all of that, the what does he call it? I was just reading this article, this great article today. I was thinking, Josh, I don't know if it's possible to share a link or two even, to capture the poetic reality of a country or an experience.
Yeah, so send me those links after the show and I'll include them with the show notes that we post afterwards.
Cool. Yeah, there was just one or two as I was thinking of today. There were a couple of those. But I think the travel writing that I like best is not simply phantasmagorically and cinematically engaging. It's not just great scene making. I read travel stories to learn. To also, to find, great details and characters and to learn maps.
Yeah. Amy, what are your thoughts on
this? Well, I'm going to follow that up. I had a lot to assume there. Again, different, I think. I definitely emphasize to the writers that I work with and the writers that I publish that showing is more important than telling. But there's a time for telling, as Colin said, like when you're trying to establish context, when you're giving historical detail. Of course, in travel writing, we always have the traditional part somewhere in the piece that says, why are we there? How did we end up there? What's going to happen next? You know, that kind of stuff. But when we begin telling about other people, telling about other cultures, telling about how others feel, telling really quickly something about how we felt without showing it, those are all mistakes in travel writing that I think we have to kind of stay away from. So there's a time for telling, but it's really contextual, you know, it's a contextual thing. Now there are writers that do a lot of telling, such as Rory MacLean and other writers, that are trying to give a lot of historical detail. D'Urville Murphy's last two books, a lot of historical detail. But
William Dalrymple.
Yeah, and I mean, that has an audience, but I would say that's probably not the travel writing publisher that I want more of. Because to me, when I'm looking at the world right now, the contemporary world that we're living in, the modern world we're living in, there's a huge space between you and I. There's a border between you and I, and there are people that want to put more borders between you and I. So for me, I see travel writing as sort of access to place, to experience, to culture, and that requires a certain kind of intimacy. And so I want people to be vulnerable in their work to an extent, which is something that Tim Cahill does masterfully. He's a master at that. He's a master at falling down and explaining what falling down is like and then what happens after falling down. And just everything that goes to his mind as he falls down. And he does it with humor and bravado and everything else. But for him, there's a lot of showing. And there's really not a lot of telling. It's a lot more storytelling heavy. So for me, I definitely emphasize showing because I see travel writing maybe in a wider lens than other travel writers might. I don't differentiate travel writing from any other kind of writing. I think travel writing is in every other genre. So, for example, I don't teach from one book of travel writing because travel writing is memoir, travel writing is nonfiction, travel writing is poetry, cartography, psychogeography, autofiction. It's in everything. All that's required is a journey. But what I'm hoping I can instill in others is that intimacy is important in your piece. Now, maybe not through the whole piece because that could be exhausting, but little glimpses of it are important. And that's where showing is vital. Showing. And showing is about where you begin your sentences. So not beginning them necessarily with I, they, he, the. Starting in a different place with the object. So for example, starting with pink rather than the blanket. So it's about writing something, putting the reader right in the present, having them feel what you feel, and hoping they come to the same conclusions that you have without telling them that they need to. If that's articulate enough, that's a big ask.
Absolutely.
Hopefully that's articulate.
So last, you touched on another point that I want to segue into. Last week we talked about short memoir, writing personal pieces, and one of the big themes there is being able to make it, to pull some universality out of your story that other people can relate to. So, Colin, I want to start with you here. When you're working on a piece, especially a travel piece, maybe you're in a foreign land that people haven't been to, how do you pull that universality out of there? How do you find the meaning in a piece that you're working on?
That's a good question. That's what I think the writer is seeking through the entire process. And I agree
with that. Yes.
I'm always encouraging writers to be asking themselves all along the way, you know, what do I want my readers to take away from this? And what am I putting out into the world, actually? If we are writing to be read, which I think any writer would say that is the goal, is to be read, not just to write in our journals and for those never to be shared, although there's a place for that too. There's been certainly tons of that across our history, but to be asking yourself those tougher questions. Why do I want to share this? What do I think a reader would take away from this? What am I trying to say, in fact, about this place, about this experience? And that's everything, you know, as Amy was saying, that's memoir, that's personal essay, that's even, there's some element of that in a destination piece, right? In finding your angle is oftentimes connected to that meaning of the story. Yeah, I think it's important. The universal is not just an opportunity for the writer to make the story really profound and hard-hitting and great. It's, I think, a responsibility. And how I mean that is so that we're not blind in thinking that we're the first person to go through or into or to be in a place that we're the first person to do it. To recognize that we are part of a very long lineage of travelers, men and women, who've gone before us and have written about these things. They've told these stories. Travel editors often say that. Don't pitch me a place. Don't pitch me a place. We've been everywhere. And that's an interesting thing to consider for the modern travel writer. We've been everywhere. What's your idea? And the idea is where that telling does come in, that thinking on the page. What's your idea about this place? What's your idea about love lost? What's your idea? What are you extracting from a car accident in Moscow in your 20s? That is, I think, the big opportunity and the responsibility for the writer. You know, we've seen scenes of everything, but we haven't heard all of the great thinking that's yet to be done.
Amy, what about you? When it comes to pulling that universality out of
a travel? Collins, I'm following him, so I have to like take all of him in and then respond. I think he's right in that travel writers do have a big responsibility. But I also think there's something really important to remember about travel stories, and that's that you're the only one that had that experience, and you're the only one who can tell that thing, and your responsibility is to that. Like, you really have to make sure that you're being true to the thing that happens to you. A while ago, something happened to me where I wrote a piece about something, and a young man from India, who I did not know, found it online and emailed me and said that he'd wanted to kill himself and had tried several times. And then he read this piece of mine, and it sort of changed his perspective on the world, and he felt more hopeful. Now, he didn't say, "I want to go to that place that you went." He said, "I saw how you changed and how you accepted something. And so I'm sort of realizing I could accept something too." It had nothing to do with travel. It had nothing to do with him going anywhere or me showing him that place. It had everything to do with sort of that universality that you're talking about of human experience and human nature. And I think that's a place travel writing can really expand, especially right now when people can't travel and people don't have passports, and many nations in the world are experiencing what it's like to be the lesser half, the people that can't get passports. And the majority of the world can't afford to travel and can't get passports. How do those people write travel? How do they transform the reader? How do they transform themselves through their experiences of doing the everyday? So I think he's right in the sense that there's a responsibility. The responsibility, though, for me, is not so much maybe communicating the place as it is kind of trying to illuminate something about human experience and hopefully meeting the reader somewhere. And even if they're not going to have the same experience, that it triggers something in them and it might alter maybe the course of their life. Mm-hmm. For example, recently I read a piece about a woman and her mother going to London, and one of my students, and it was an uneasy relationship that they had. And right after I read the piece, I called my mother. This is a small thing, but like that actually matters, you see. Like, it triggered something in me, and I thought, wow, you know, a lot of things that she talks about, you know, not wanting to travel with her mother, I have that same trepidation about not wanting to travel with my mother. Hey, Mom, if you're watching, I'm sorry. So I think what I want to do with travel writing is, and in the writing that I publish, is I want it to turn on a switch, either empathy, turning off apathy, or changing something, transforming something in that person's life, how they look at something. It could be a country, could be a culture, could be an experience, but it also could be just something in their everyday life.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard you both touch on the setting of a piece, and it's interesting because it sounds like setting isn't what sells a travel piece. It's the experience that you have there. So Amy, I'm curious, how big of a role does setting play in a travel piece? Does it, I mean, obviously it matters because that's where this all happened, but how much should the writer be emphasizing where it happened?
For me, travel writing is the vehicle. It's not the story. Mm-hmm. Another thing Tim always would say is traveling is not a story. Going somewhere is not a story. You know, somebody could give me an entire book about all the things they've done and there's no story in that. And that's definitely true. You know, going somewhere is not enough. There has to be something that actually happens. And that point of something actually happening is like a point on the map. So you have the story before the thing happened, and then you have the thing that happened, and then you have the thing afterwards. In general, in a classic travel piece, that's sort of what it looks like. And that point could be at the beginning, the middle, or the end. So I think setting, I think I used the phrase sense of place. So more around place-based writing, which is writing with a strong sense of place. So travel writing has to have a sense of place because that's the setting, that's the conveyor belt for the experience that's going to happen that I'm going to share with you. Mm-hmm. So sense of place is very important. It could be describing things in a historical way, or it could be describing things in a kinesthetic way, like going on a hike. And describing like the nature of the landscape or your sense of smallness when you're in Antarctica or whatever it is. But the sense of place is very important. And if the writer uses that appropriately, we will be breathless. Mm-hmm. We'll be carried through it. And so we'll automatically land at the spot where something happens without having to work too hard.
Colin, what are your thoughts on sense of place and setting in a travel piece?
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about travel writing, obviously it's a maxing out of sensory detail, like Amy was talking about earlier, for sure. I mean, we're talking about setting and the external environment being a huge part of the story, right? So yes, for any travel writer, turning on, those scene making elements, sensory details.
Yeah, you're sort of like, I tell people you're a little bit like a playwright. So you're deciding who all the characters are, and you're making lists of them, and you're setting the scene, but you're also the guy who builds the scene. You're the light guy. You're everybody. You're everybody when you're writing a travel piece, when you're setting it up. And so you have to have the setting, the scene, the sense of place is very important. Otherwise, you don't have a play. You have no stage.
And those
nothing can happen on.
Those notes that you're taking also that we talked about before and capturing experiences and places while they're still fresh in your senses is so effective. And to have that, then to be able to recreate scenes out of that. And yes, that advice too, to go back and try and find photographs, all those techniques for recovering the physical environment of the story. Keep the stories physical, right? Keep reasserting the settings. Keep reminding the reader in various ways of the physical appearances of people. Those things aren't just one and done. You don't just describe those things once and then that's it. Those are, you're reasserting the physical world throughout the story.
It's very braided what you're talking about. Like, sense of place has to be all the way through the piece. But in general, in travel writing, there are a couple loose rules. So in general, there's always, as I said, that paragraph that sort of sets the stage and sort of explains why you're where you are. But it doesn't necessarily happen right at the beginning. It could happen anywhere. But in general, it's in the first third of the piece. At some point, we have that idea of setting. And in general, we have more heavy physical description in the first third of the piece than only at the end, because we want to have that sense of where you are. So you have to have a lot of that stuff, especially in the very beginning, I think. Mm-hmm.
And we touched on this already a little bit, and I try not to talk about the pandemic as much as possible, but I feel like it relates more to travel writing than any other form of writing. So, Amy, you touched on this a little bit, but how has travel writing been affected by the pandemic? Is it irreversible? Is it something that's always going to be a brand new thing? Or what have you seen, both in your own writing and on the editorial side?
On the editorial side, my magazine has had a lot of loss because our journal is not focused on merely an editorial team that's in the West where people have more financial resources. Most of our staff that's not in the West is economically disadvantaged at this point or may have had severe losses. And then a lot of our staff, of course, is in Britain. We're a British literary journal, so we have had people also have a lot of losses. So loss of life. We've also lost writers, have passed away. So we are closed down for the year. I just decided it wasn't a good idea to ask people for a volunteer project, which is what we are. We're all volunteers, to continue working on things. It's very difficult for people to work on things when something might happen any minute. But I feel like that's changing now. I think people are getting more used to the groove of it. And we're coming back in January, maybe 10 times as big as we were before. We've been all working behind the scenes. I think it's been an opportunity to reassess as an editor what we want to be doing. So we decided we would go ahead and launch a actual publishing house and publish books, which is something we wanted to do. But we took this time, this respite, to work on that. And a lot of people working in travel writing are doing things like that. They're taking this time to work on, okay, well, what do we want to be publishing? What do we want to do next? It's changed our themes. We're going to have an issue about traveling home, like traveling right where you are. I don't think we would have had anything like that before. But as far as the pandemic and how it affects travel, I think at first it was very depressing for people that are traditional travel writers where they're going on commercial assignments or they're used to traveling a lot and all of a sudden they can't, and that might have been a lot of their identity. But in other ways, I think it's been a good opportunity for people to work on craft, to work on the stories that they haven't, that they've had, that they haven't been able to fine tune, to work on literature, to become better writers. But I do think it has a lasting effect. Yeah, because it's devastating for the whole world. It's devastating for people individually. But for travel, how does it change it? I actually think people will go back to traveling and probably travel more than ever before, especially after this. Looking at how it has looked in countries that have opened up and what happens. People start traveling more. I think there's going to be more travel opportunities, but how it's going to affect travel writing is, I think it's going to become even more important to do the kinds of things Colin and I are talking about. Making meaningful work is going to be more important. And people are going to want to travel, but they're going to want to travel and read about meaningful journeys. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden that's become more important, I think, than just going and sitting on a beach and drinking Mai Tais. That's maybe not as important. You know, I think what's more important is, does sound nice, but so, I mean, I think what's going to be important are.
Mexico? Amy, where in Mexico are you?
I'm in San Miguel de Allende.
Which is quite south?
It's in the center part in Guanajuato. It's Condé Nast, I think, was Condé Nast, the most beautiful city in the world, many years running recently. So I'm sitting in a wonderful place to be stuck. Cool. I'm stuck in a wonderful place. I think people are, what I'm seeing is people writing the stories that have been on their minds, thinking more carefully about what they want to do, what they want to see, what they want to publish, what they want to write. So I think it's actually an exciting time. Mm-hmm. I think it will be very exciting when the virus is over, because people will be better at writing. There is true, though, that people struggle writing right now. Mm-hmm. It's hard to write right now. You know, it's hard to not get distracted by everything going on in the world. So I think it depends on the individual.
Heard quite a bit of that. Yep.
Colin, how has the pandemic affected your writing? Your writing, both your process and just being able to get ideas to write about?
You know, thankfully I was working on a story, a feature, a very personal story before the pandemic hit, which has definitely affected the traveling I need to do to investigate the story. But that's been sustaining because I can do other things for the story while waiting to be able to make those trips. But I kind of like the element of more solitude and quiet and a simpler life. You hear that all the time. Wonderful travel writer, Tony Perrottet. Do you know Tony, Amy? Tony writing about...
Yeah, I know him, yeah. Yeah.
Just, you know, the long history of isolation, lots of great literature being born out of isolation and quarantine or exile or imprisonment, for example. There are so many great, vivid examples of that. So, yeah, I would say there's just still as great an opportunity as ever to tell it.
I mean, you know, to go off of that, personally for myself, at the same time that the virus happened, I have a nerve disease, and they told me I could never fly again the same month that the virus was announced. And I'm someone who's famous for walking across countries by myself. So that was startling, and you would think it would be really depressing that I find myself in the city and I can't go anywhere. So even after virus, I can't go anywhere. But I have actually really enjoyed it, because I'm just traveling like 10 blocks around my house because of the virus, and there's so many stories here. It's like I'm just uncovering constantly more and more things. And so for me, I think my work's better because I'm not always thinking about the next place I'm going to go. I'm not always pitching the next thing. I'm not always trying to fund the next trip. And I don't know how it is for you, Colin, but it's like to have that pressure removed, to be in one place, to just work on the work, and also experience and experiment differently with how I travel, even around my own city, it's very interesting to me because before I used to have to go do something extremely epic and hard. So every time I finished something epic and hard, I would then plan the next epic hard trip. I was supposed to be crossing Japan when the virus hit. Of course, that got canceled. And that was many months of a trip. And now I'm not doing that. I'm walking 5 blocks. But it's like, it's such an interesting 5 blocks. I never looked at it before. I feel like now I'm looking at everything so much differently now. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that the quarantine, as tough and trying as it is, can inspire is the long look back. The longer look back at some trips maybe we've taken that we haven't dusted off and unpacked and thought about or written about yet. And I think that's exciting, right? Because you get that vicarious thrill. It often makes me think of Marco Polo, right? A great travel book, his Divisamente du Monde, The Description of the World, which I don't know if people have read, but it's a little bit laborious. He's incredibly repetitive in that book, but it's also just an awesome read. But when it wasn't until he was in prison, think of quarantine or isolation. It wasn't until he was back in Italy and in prison that he had the time, that he had that time and isolation to be able to go back and tell his story about his journey from Venice all the way into the Far East. And so this quarantine, I think, is a good opportunity for people to think about some of those amazing trips, whether they're close by, like Amy was saying, they could be close by. It doesn't mean on the other side of the world only. Mm-hmm.
So I have to get into some audience questions now, because we've got some great questions sitting here. First one, I want to ask this to Amy. These days, it seems to me that so much travel writing appears to be mainly a PR piece for certain hotels, restaurants, etc., full of links and so forth. Can you comment on whether there is still a place to write just straight travel?
That's a really interesting question. I think if you think about early travel writing, a lot of times it was PR. So early explorers, travelers, you can think about early people that were trying to discover things such as minerals, gold, water, mountains, resources. They were making maps, and they were bringing those maps of artificial places or lands or whatever they decided was there back to the people that had money and power, and they were selling something. So travel writing's history itself, very rarely was someone going from place to place. I mean, we have Sarashina Nikki. She was the first woman travel writer in history, and she wrote a diary, travel diary, traveling across China. So she was traveling from one palace to another, and she kept a diary, and that diary was published as actual travel writing at the time. It's the earliest travel writing we have by a woman. And clearly there's no advertorial things in there. If we skip a little bit ahead and we think about journalism, say 90 years ago to about 30 years ago, travel writing had a commercial heyday. And it became a lot of PR. And now what's happened is PR companies almost don't even exist. Advertorial companies don't exist. Travel writers now do the advertorial copy. Is there a place for actual travel writing? The problem with that question is the kind of writing you're talking about is actual travel writing. It's just a different kind of travel writing. And I think one thing we have to work on, and something I work on myself, is to include all of the kinds of travel writing, whether it's travel blogging or PR or literature. For myself, I have made a decision to focus entirely on literature. But that's a luxury. That's a luxury to be able to do that, and a huge sacrifice to be able to focus only on literature and not publish anything commercial. But yes, I think there is a lot of room. There's Nowhere Magazine. There's Elsewhere out of Germany. There's Panorama, my journal. There's numerous journals. As a matter of fact, feel free to find me on Facebook and message me. I'll give you a list of like 100 places you could publish travel literature around the world. Cold Noon. There's lots of different places. But the question, I think, to rephrase that question, is how can we recontextualize travel writing so that literature has just as an important place as commercial travel writing? that would be another way to think about that question. Like, how could we make it so that travel literature has just big of a place? Or when you tell someone you're a travel writer, they don't assume that your plane seat is free. Maybe you write travel poems. You know, I think we need to sort of widen our perception of what travel writing is. And how we can do that is by moving more into literary magazines and things like that, literary places, or narrative nonfiction journalism. Those are the two places where we can really expand it. So I'd love to talk about that more. So message me, whoever you are, if you'd like to hear more about it.
Yeah, and that's where I think, just piggybacking on that, is the transparency. One of the two links that I would like to be happy to share, Josh, with the with our audience, talks about this. It's, I think, a great article. It's called What Ad Execs Should Know About Travel Writing. And it's just a great piece that illuminates many of these topics. I think for writers that, yes, are on the literary side of it, it's good to know that the genre, the category of travel writing, is such a hybrid, and it's so vast. But your transparency, in other words, for example, David Foster Wallace on his trips, a supposedly fun thing, he's very transparent that he is a paid writer on assignment for this magazine. And he still tells a literary story, but it, it's also self-conscious in a very positive way. It's transparent about purpose and the money behind it, so to speak. And I think that's a very powerful and scrupulous and winning way to approach it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that question itself is like a many hour conversation, but it's a fascinating conversation. And I think it's something, just to touch on it one more time, I think it's important. And something I've learned over time is, when I started, I thought I would only be writing literature, and then I was told I had to write top 10 lists, and I was really upset because I didn't want to do that. Then I wrote a lot of top 10 lists, and I learned, you know, I really suck at top 10 lists, but I'm great at literature. So I think in travel writing, the issue we have is that as a genre, it's not taken seriously by other literary genres because it includes so a hybridization of so many different kinds of things.
Right.
But what we can do as, I mean, if you're a writer of literature, which it sounds like you are, what we can do is we can keep putting literature up front. You know, we can keep putting it up front because, and doing it in an inviting way, not in an exclusive way, but inviting everybody in, inviting anyone who starts a travel blog or anyone who writes a commercial piece. Our goal is to help everybody write better, to write the travel writing that they write better. And if we can touch on it from that point of view, like Panorama, for example, it brings on many writers that have never written travel literature in their lives, but they might have been a National Geographic and they might be a travel influencer, but they might not know how to write, and we help them write. So in my mind, there's space for everybody. But what's most important is that we all learn to write well. It's not enough to want to write travel. That to me, say, well, I want to be a travel writer, but I don't want to learn to write. What we need to do is encourage people to write well.
So next question, quite a few questions about how to pitch a travel travel piece. So Amy, we'll start with you on this one. What are you looking for in a travel writing pitch?
Panorama doesn't generally accept pitches because we are a literary magazine and we don't pay. However, we do sometimes take ideas, and certainly I've pitched lots of commercial pieces. Let me address that in two ways. First of all, what do we accept? We usually complete pieces, but sometimes we take ideas. And the idea has to be well rendered. I think in the email, first of all, you have to follow the instructions of how to submit, because if you don't, that just kills it right there. So that's the number one thing I would say. Make sure you address it to the right person. Make sure that it answers the questions that are asked on the submission call. And then the second thing would be the body of it itself has to sound like you. It has to show something about you, about your writing, about who you are in the world, your style. What makes you different? Why? Why you for that story? That's the most important thing. And then that segues over to, you know, what Colin said about don't pitch a place. You know, back in the day when I was writing for BBC and things like that quite a bit, I once was going to be in Uganda, and there were some beautiful islands there, and I thought, well, I really wish I could just write about islands. So I sent an email to the editor, and I said, I'd like to write about these islands. And she said, don't send me this pitch. How dare you? So I researched, and I found out that there were some people that guarded a tree with rifles, and that it was this holy tree, and that it was connected to the snake that came out of the lake, and so on and so forth. And off I went on assignment, okay, because I found a story. So if you're pitching a commercial thing, you have to have this story, and you have to answer some very important questions. You have to show your research, so you have to do a little bit of research, like when was the last time something like this was written about? That's yeah. important. And maybe even add links, like it was written about in, you know, 1986 was the last time this island was written about.
Yeah, and editors,
what's different about the story?
What, right, they're keen on building some continuity even in the public record, as it were. I find that's also part of it too. Editors are keen on doing that. Well, 2 years ago, someone in a different magazine wrote about this place, but here's how my idea takes it somewhere further.
Yes.
It builds on that, as yeah. it were.
So we are, there's so many good questions here, but unfortunately.
A simple answer is how is like, that's okay. Let me just, I'll just finish answering this. Simple
sure.
answer to that would.
I think we're having some internet issues. Amy, are you still with us?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can hear you.
We can hear you.
Yeah, I think so. Same with you.
I think we have a little bit of a delay here. It seems like you're caught up again. So if you want to continue where you left off.
Oh, I just want to say a quick answer to that question is keep it to two paragraphs. Address the editor. That find out who the editor is that you're going to submit to. Answer the questions how, why, where, what, why you, and then do a little research about when it was last published, and then a polite salutation. I look forward to hearing from you. That's it. Very simple. And also, yeah. if the editor declines it, it doesn't mean anything about you. It doesn't mean it's not a good story. They might have someone else that wants to write that story. And if you know someone who's written a pitch before, if you know them well enough, try sending them your pitch and ask them what they think. You know, ask them, hey, can you help me clean this up a little? Writers do help other writers in that way.
Colin, did you have something to add there real quick?
Yeah, no, it's similar. I heard it put simply in a good pitch. Why this story? Why now? And why you? Just like Amy was saying. So, and if you account for those three things in a pretty economical pitch, you'll be in a strong position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, so that takes us to the end of our time for today. Thank you, Colin and Amy. You've been wonderful guests. This was a great discussion. Again, this is Inside Writing, brought to you by Gotham Writers Workshop. We'll be back again next week, same time, same place. We're going to be talking about personal essay, so we hope to see you then. And again, check the YouTube and our podcast notes. We're going to have links that Colin mentioned, and Amy, if there are any links you want to provide as well, send those to me and we can provide those for our listeners. Again, Colin, Amy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And everyone, we'll see you next week. Have a good one.